Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Kiva, a Greenhorns partner and nonprofit that has helped hundreds of farmers raise over $2 million in microloans, all without charging any interest or fees. Find out more at us.kiva.org/greenhorns.
I'm Erin Fairbanks, host of The Farm Report. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Greenhorns Radio, radio for young farmers, by young farmers. This is your host, Severin. I am calling in you now from Santa Fe Community College, here flyering for the Our Land Symposium. It's a big deal because I spent a lot of the summer hunched over inviting speakers from around the country to come and talk about the landscape scale issues that we faced in our land use, land governance, land transition, land access, land succession, land affordability crises, and the opportunity that there is for land repair, land commoning, community land trusts. And that is exciting. It's called Our Land 2. It's a symposium over the course of 7 days and an exhibit that lasts all month. And it's very wonderful, and I hope that if you can't come in person or tell your people that you will tell people near here to come and listen to it online. Speaking of land, today we have a landscape interpretation of a different kind. We're going to talk about natural navigation with our host, Tristan Gooley, who writes about these things and has studied this work. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And he's coming all the way from England, I should have mentioned. Would you mind introducing yourself briefly and the work that you do?
Yeah, you got my name right. It's a bit unusual, Tristan Gooley. And natural navigation's been my work full-time for 10 years, but part-time all of my life. And it's the beautiful and rare art of knowing how to find your way using nature. So people probably guess, you know, sun, moon, and stars. Your listeners are probably familiar with some of the plant techniques, but there might be quite a few that they're not familiar with. And then the animals and all sorts of other wonderful things as well.
So who are the kinds of people that are using these methods traditionally?
Well, it's really interesting because I think navigation is one of our, you know, it's one of our fundamental skills. Nobody can go a day without eating, drinking, sleeping, and navigating pretty much. But a mistake I think we make as societies all over the world is to think everything's about necessity. And it applies as much to navigation as food. When we think about the struggle with food that societies have had for thousands of years, we made the mistake of thinking it's all about quantity, and then that leads to all sorts of other problems. And then we realize, well, actually, quality and all the thought that goes into the difference between, you know, food that's well made and enjoyed for what it can be. The same's true of navigation. You know, if we think that navigation is all about, you know, the fastest way of getting from A to B, we miss all of the fun that our ancestors were having when they were using the stars and all the other fun methods.
So many of us are becoming aware of the trade routes that shaped expansion, colonial expansion, and as you know, here we are over here in the colonies or the ex-colonies of the United Kingdom. We were the product of a shipping empire, and many of our ancestors were on board ships, were captains, or were shanghaied into service as sailors. Others of us came as slaves on ships. Others of us came from Spain through Mexico. Others of us were here already. Anyway, many of us had something to do with navigating our way into this territory. Can you talk a little bit about the nautical traditions that inform your work?
Yeah, absolutely. I've spent a lot of time over the last few years researching this for a book I wrote recently called How to Read Water. And it's if you just take the idea that whenever we look at water, we never see the same thing twice. It doesn't matter if we're looking at a puddle or a small pond or a lake or a river or a sea or a massive ocean. It's impossible to see the same thing twice. And when we start to ask the question why, that takes us into some of the skills that all of our ancestors used. I mean, some of the ones you mentioned there, but we can go back even earlier. By the time human beings were writing anything down, so the start of our understanding of history in many ways, most of the land masses in the world have been populated. And we have to ask, how did that happen? And the answer tends to be, you know, a nice combination of skill, trial and error, a lot of courage, some happy stories and some sad stories. But for me, the interesting part is that we can still use these skills today. So just, you know, what might appear to one person on a beach to be just waves to another person is, you know, that's like it's a sign, it's a code. It's telling you what the weather's about to do. It's telling you, you know, whether there's land just out of sight. And actually, we can see those patterns even in a pond, you know, even if you're several hundred miles from the coast, you can still see exactly the same patterns.
So I know that the Polynesians were looking at waves and wave patterns in their navigation of their archipelagic diaspora. Can you tell that story?
Yeah, the Polynesians are, you know, there are other cultures that did it, the Vikings, the Arab navigators, and quite a few others. But the Polynesians were particularly interesting culturally because their expertise was cut off from the rest of the world. It wasn't until the 18th century when a few mainly European navigators started passing through the Pacific Islands that we were even aware what was going on out there. And in a nutshell, what they were doing was they treated the sea in the way we treated land. So, you know, most Western societies, when we think of maps, we think, okay, well, the sea is the blue bit, and then when we get to land, we're going to do our best to work out where the hills are. We'll give a bit of information about where the rivers are. If it's a really detailed map, you might mark the difference between the different types of forest, coniferous or deciduous. Whereas the Polynesian, the Pacific Islanders, took that level of detail looking at the shape of swells and waves within the ocean. So for them, once you're on land, navigating's over because the islands are generally quite small, low-lying. You can see from one side to the other and a few of them. But in between, what a lot of people assume is just sort of a random mix of waves, to these expert navigators, they looked at those the same way we would look at a range of hills, as in there's a character there, there's a way of reading it. And once you understand the relationship between the wind and the sea, it's surprisingly easy to make sense of. And as I'm saying, you can practice these skills by looking at the way waves bump off a rock in a pond, or even off a tiny stone in a puddle. Exactly the same stuff's going on, and it's a great way into what was considered a totally inaccessible skill.
So this kind of observation that was, of course, crucial and necessary before we had sonar and radar and weather predicting software and agencies devoted to gathering data. Actually, that reminds me of a really cool guy I read about in the 1880s who had a fleet of 5,000 boats who were filling in data about going around Cape Horn. It was like the very beginning of an open source weather collection agency. Did you know about that guy?
It's. I don't think I know exactly the one you're talking about. But it sounds a little bit like the sort of stuff that somebody called Fitzroy was doing. He was. You're right. There was this sort of pioneering time where people were trying to make sense of a whole load of observations, and so people just started taking interest in a way that, you know, the pressure drops and then the bad weather arrives. Stuff that's old news to us, you know. particularly those of us who work outdoors, your listeners, me and quite a few others. But, you know, there were things that indigenous cultures had known for long before Western society started formalizing this. So a good example is, pretty much all Northern Hemisphere indigenous societies were aware that when you see a halo around the sun or the moon or the stars, that's a sign that the weather may deteriorate, because in modern terms, it's the high ice clouds. It's cirrus and then cirrostratus, which creates that halo, and many of your listeners will be well familiar with that. It doesn't guarantee bad weather, because cirrostratus doesn't guarantee that a front's coming through, but it's just one part of the jigsaw. So, yeah, all of this stuff sort of fits together, and there's a slight sort of arrogance in a lot of contemporary thought that we started to make sense of the weather, 100 maybe years ago, whereas in fact, there were people 2,000 years ago who were undertaking journeys, and they wouldn't set off if they saw the halo around the sun, or if they noticed the wind direction change by even 30 degrees, they'd say, okay, well, that's not normal. I'm not going to set off.
So that brings us to that's not normal. And again, the growers, we rely on weather predictions better than the almanac, often a result of very expensive government satellites that's linked with defense spending and research and benefit from that kind of climate awareness. But we also are, as growers, observing a lot of changes in the climate. Just even in our few years of experience, this past summer had record droughts in the northeast of the United States. Obviously, the past few years have been record droughts in the West Coast. And, we are experiencing major changes. I wonder if you could talk about how other people and places are interpreting the changes that they experience.
Yeah, there's absolutely the one thing the whole world, I think, is pretty much agreed on is that there's a lot of change going on. There's a lot of debate about how much is man-made, and I certainly I'm not in a position or authority to be able to say I have the final answer on that. We have a history of over worrying about things, and then whether it's technology or other stuff like that. And this, if I'm honest, this is an area I really just do not know. I mean, the scientists are not unanimous, but there is a very, very, large majority saying that there's man-made factors. There's always been climate change. The climate's never been static. It's just, if I'm honest, I the scientists know better than me, and I have to go with what I hear there. But then when I look at historical records, we were having all sorts of crazy weather phenomenon as far back as history goes. So it's really, really hard to get perspective on these things. I just have to. It's one of those areas that the things I can say with certainty. I can tell you, you can find the North Star using all sorts of wonderful different constellations. I can say that with certainty. When it comes to climate change, I just have to hold my hands up and say, they're probably better qualified people than me to give an authoritative opinion on that.
Well, then let's. Knowing what we cannot control seems to be one of the key things. And, one thing I do know is that there are efforts in phenology in collecting information about the first flowerings and the first time you see animals and when the first frost is and that kind of data. So there is a whole kind of citizen science initiative around gathering highly locally specific biological indicators.
Yeah.
But let's go back to your area of focus, because that's what we're here to talk about. What is it that you're teaching in your workshops? And can you give us a couple of lessons that we can learn over the radio?
Yeah, well, I think very sort of relevant to your listeners will be natural navigation can be thought of for two sides of a coin. You can have sort of farming and other ways of looking at the landscape, like gardening on one side of the coin, and natural navigation and other things are on a different side of the same coin. So to give you actual examples, you know, there are many, many plants that can tolerate wet ground. You know, and I'm quite often in wild areas, and I'm looking out for plants, you know, like rushes, and they're telling me the ground is wet there. So they're basically saying to me, if you head this way, you'll get wet. But a farmer is obviously going to look at the ground differently and say, okay, well, this type of soil is very dry. This type of soil is very wet. This bit of soil maybe has got a bit of salt in. This type of soil is very acidic. This type of soil is very alkaline. All of those things can be used for navigation. So, you know, if I'm at the top of a hill, I'm looking down and I see, okay, if I go that way, there are a load of beech trees. If I go that way, I see a load of willows. That's telling me that, you know, okay, I'm looking for a river. Let's head towards the willows. That's where the river will be. All of that is just a different side of the same coin to our sort of planting, putting plants in. And the same thing with animals. You know, animals will thrive on certain soils because certain foods, and other animals will really struggle, which is why when you look at the map of farming patterns around the world, there's, you know, these great trends to do, you know, the soil's a massive thing, but also the amount of sunlight, the amount of rain, exposure is a good example. If you go up to a certain altitude, farming becomes, you move from arable to pasture, and then it becomes impossible because it's too high and it's too exposed. Well, in natural navigation, we're doing the same thing, but with a slightly different perspective. So as you move up from a valley up the hills into the mountains, you move from deciduous trees to conifers to the tree line where there are no trees, then you move on to the grasses, and then you move on to bare rocks. But within that, there are subtleties. So trees get shorter with altitude and that sort of thing. So you could see that as a plant, altimeter. It's telling you how high you are. And then you look at the shape of forests. You can work out north, south, east, and west. There are 19 ways you can navigate using a tree, starting from the fairly obvious, as in you get more growth on the side the sun is. So if you're in the northern hemisphere, you get more, particularly north of the tropics, you get more growth on the south side.
So how does that apply? How would that help, for instance, situating an orchard would be something that new agrarians are doing a lot, or figuring out where to situate a shed for cows to be sheltered, or figuring out where to put a fence. Often we are learning from our elders that we should do everything with electric first before we commit anything. Well, and most of us stay with electric almost forever, but can you explain a little bit how, in locating some of these landscape features of the agrarian infrastructure, we would be using some of these techniques?
Yeah, absolutely. There's probably a farmer somewhere in the world where conditions are so perfect that whatever they do, things work out well. But my understanding of farming is generally isn't like that. So you're tending to either deal with too much of something or too little of something most of the time. If you take, very, very hot parts of the world, breeze is a good thing by and large because you're getting the temperature down on average to something nearer you want. So you would, if you're putting a building, you'd put it side on to the prevailing wind, so you're getting more breeze. If you're in a part of the world where exposure is a problem and low temperatures are more of an issue, then you situate a building in line with the prevailing winds. And there's lots of similarities between that and architecture all over the world. So not that far from where I live, when you go up into the mountains of places like Wales and Scotland, and it'll be true of large parts of the States and all over the world as well, you find these buildings are exactly in line with the prevailing wind direction. But when you go to the tropics, you find they're side on to the winds. There are all sorts of subtleties. So if you're in a place that's getting lots and lots of snow each winter, you know, people who are in that situation, you know, learn this very quickly. So I might not be teaching anybody in terms of your listeners this, but a lot of people I work with aren't familiar with this, that, you know, when snow comes in with the wind, there's an actual pattern in terms of how much of it gets deposited on the lee, on the downwind side of any obstacle. So it's not as simple as it just gets dumped on the lee side. There's a dumping, and then there's a gap, and then there's another little dumping, and that sort of thing. And you know, so once you get used to all those patterns, you can situate all of these things to help you. You can't. None of us, I think, is ever trying to beat nature. We're just trying to sort of work out, you know, smart ways of working with it, aren't we?
and I'm thinking about, you know, wind blocks and hedgerows. And in the upper Midwest, we have snow. People plant hedges against prevailing snow. I guess the question would be, in the beginning of starting to tune in your natural navigator, other than reading your wonderful book and your wonderful essay in the Almanac, what would be some kind of beginner practices or daily practices that you could recommend?
Well, the one I say, the very first one I say to people is just ask yourself the question, which way am I looking at times when you don't need it? You know, you're just, you know, you're out there doing a job and you just look up and you go, which way am I looking? And if somebody's very used to doing that, if somebody's never done it before, I say to them, you know, just have a stab north, south, east or west. And for people who aren't used to the outdoors, that's a challenge enough to start with. You know, once you know where the sun is, that's very straightforward. So then at the next stage, I say to people, don't just go for north, south, east, west. Let's be a bit more ambitious. You know, you 5 degrees east to south, why? You know, and that brings us right into being really finely tuned to all of the astronomical clues, the sun, moon, and stars. I mean, using the moon is really accurately is really quite challenging. And there are nice simple methods. You join the horns of a crescent moon in a line and extend that down to the horizon, and you'll be looking south from most northern parts of the world. But to actually use the moon really accurately takes an awful lot of practice. Stars are they're both straightforward and fun. So using the Big Dipper or Cassiopeia or any other of these quite straightforward constellations, you can find north within a degree very, very quickly. But, you know, the difference between that and being quite advanced and just seeing maybe a break in the clouds and seeing four stars and going, okay, you know, I'm going to try and work out north just from those four stars. That's a different game. And then, you know, it's an overcast day, there's no wind, you're going to try and find which way you're looking just from, you know, the lichens on a tree or just from the way the animals are behaving, those sorts of things. And what I would say to people, it doesn't matter if you get it wrong, because you're not doing it to save your life, you're not doing it to cross a great ocean or something, you're doing it to tune in and just see your landscape in a slightly different way.
And then this tuning in, I mean, this is really wonderful to hear because, you know, you start really noticing the patterns of where the birds are singing and where the sounds are located in the landscape and becoming aware of those little subtle changes. What I'm wondering is the kind of unexpected rewards that you discover as a result. Well, it's like today I saw a coyote, and I heard it before I saw it, which was kind of great because it was so quiet. But many of us don't having so much quiet. But what happens to the observer from the observing?
I think the real key is not to feel we have to do this, that it's a chore, it's something you have to, you know, it's another thing on our to-do list for the day, but actually just to find ways of making it fun. So almost all of my work is this idea of clues. So the thing I say to people is every single thing you see outdoors is a clue to something. So just take something we're all probably very familiar with, the stinging nettle. You know, how can that be a clue to something? Well, stinging nettles don't grow everywhere. They grow in phosphate-rich soil. Phosphate-rich soil is nearly always a sign of civilization. So you start noticing in farms are actually stuffed with stinging nettles because of, you know, particularly farms that are using fertilizers and things like that. But even ones that aren't, there'll be animals, and the animals lead to phosphate accumulation in certain places. But if we take a slightly wilder perspective on that, you can walk for, you know, 20 miles across the wild and you won't see a stinging nettle. The second you see one, it's saying to you, ah, somebody was here before me. And nearly always it's a sign of humans having done something, lived there, worked there, died there. So even something as humble as the stinging nettle is part of a bigger map.
And then all those are just more and more and more clues that we can track.
Yeah, that's it. It's, you know, absolutely every plant, every animal, even every building, the way people behave, all of it is part of a map if we choose to see it that way. I mean, just a fun sort of town example. You know, if you're in a big town or city and you're completely lost and you just want to get some handle on something, if you go against the flow of people in the morning or with the flow of people in the late afternoon, you find a station. Because we're all individuals, but like all the animals, all the other animals in the world, we behave in flock type ways as well. So, yeah, there's nothing that isn't part of a map.
And then once we have the map, then we have the power to be more strategic in our interventions and more tactical in our initiatives and potentially more resilient in our enterprises.
Yeah, totally. It's about awareness. In my experience, if you tell somebody to be aware of nature and the outdoors, you get nowhere. But if you show them some fun techniques, you know, starting maybe with a few stars and then showing them, you know, a dozen different ways to find north using a tree, people don't resist. They go, yeah, that's fun, I'll do that. And those that leads to an awareness which, you know, I know many farmers have naturally through their work, but you know, an awful lot of people, a lot of people who spend all their time in towns, you know, this is the way I get them interested. I say, don't try and connect with nature because you feel you ought to, you know, but try some of these techniques because they're fun and they work.
Well, I think it's a pretty exciting pathway into the wild and into a wild inside. A lot of similarities to the guy and Tom Brown School, who's kind of famous, cult famous over here. You know that guy?
I do. Yeah. I've read quite a few of his books. Yeah.
Yeah, he's big in the Pine Barrens. He's in New Jersey, studying a lot of native ways. And those guys are really fun, those trackers. It's fun to cruise around with. Trackers and artists, fun to cruise around with. Like being with wild dogs a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, natural navigation and tracking, again, you know, there's a part of natural navigation that sort of marries up with almost every outdoor pursuit. So if you take tracking, if you're, I know there are huge ranches in the States and Australia and other places where because it's private land, you don't have a sort of state map of it and you don't have signs at all the junctions. And one of the techniques that I've seen and been told loads of times is that if you're going from a small track or road or track, you know, route of any kind that meets a major one, if you just look on the ground, you can see which way people turn most often. And that'll always be the route home because people tend to, you know, and it's the same with farm animals. In the UK, I can always find a farm by looking for the corner gates because it's always easier to get animals out through a corner than through the middle of the side of a field. So there are all these different techniques that, are, you know, tracking obviously is much more detailed in some areas, but that's where natural navigation and tracking kind of meet. There's always these fun little spots.
Well, I hope that we have inspired some people to go and check out natural navigation and Tristan Gourley.
Yeah.
And also, of course, your essay is in the New Farmer's Almanac, which comes out in November. And it's a great essay. It's full of great essays, actually. I think there's almost 100 essays in there. Great value for $20 or buy a box and sell them on. Thank you so much for being on the show. Would you want to just give the names of your titles and your website for everyone who's listening?
Thanks a lot. Yeah, the website is naturalnavigator.com. And my books are The Natural Navigator, The Lost Art of Reading Nature Signs, and How to Read Water.
Thank you so much for what you do, and thank you all for listening to another episode of Greenhorns Radio, sponsored by Kiva. And please, please, please notice what you're noticing and keep a good journal. It might be important someday. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening. Till my love for you.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.